Welcome back to The Drop. This is Michael Saramella here to talk about everything that happened this week in surfing, and we are kicking it off with a bang. You probably saw on Instagram that Mick Fanning split with Red Bull after 23 years together, but we have the backstory, the actual origins of this arrangement, and it is pretty crazy. Mick basically pulled off the impossible and as a result made a heaping sum of money over those 23 years in a situation where it seemed like that wasn't on the table at all. Speaking of money, we're also going to talk about the Bitcoin boys, Cale Walsh and Russell Bjerke. They won, obviously, our Stab Surfer of the Year the last 2 years, and Bitcoin just hit its all-time high, so we talked to them to figure out what they're doing, if they've sold, if they've held, if they've spent it all on NFTs, whatever. We're going to figure that out from them. Buck has a piece. He's in Portugal right now, honestly. He lives there, and it's kind of an existential question. Should you surf a CT venue when the CT is in town? And last but not least, we're going to break down the Stab in the Dark finale. Let's drop in.
I'm just so happy that what's-his-name won Stab in the Dark this year.
Yeah, we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that.
Did you see that?
Yeah, I did see that.
Did you see it?
We actually...
What was his name? Can you say it here?
Well, I'm going to say it later on. And so if you don't want to know the winner of Stab in the Dark, there's going to be a point at this podcast at which we tell you to turn it off, because we are going to do a major spoiler in here because we want to talk about it. Like, it's a big deal. But we also realize that some of the people listening to this podcast maybe haven't seen it yet, and we don't want to spoil your entire weekend and an entire series just with this podcast. So we're going to talk about the news, and then we'll get into the winner of Stab in the Dark toward the end. We'll let you know when it's going to happen. But yeah, Buck, it was really funny. We were in the Australian office when they were doing the premiere over at La Paloma, and we got the team over there to set up a Google Meets so that we had a computer in like the control room that was just pointing down at the fans and the screen, so we could like be part of the premiere from afar.
If we shared that link, I bet a bunch of people would have joined, actually.
Well, that was...
Just imagine how sick that would have been. We would have had to put it on mute because there would have just been cowboys yelling, and I would have loved all of them for doing so. But did that come up, that idea?
Yeah, well, it actually just made us realize, like, oh, we should just be doing a live broadcast of the world premiere. Like, that's... I think next year that's what we'll do. Like, we'll still do the world premiere like we did it, but then we'll make it available to all premium members who can tune in online so they can be kind of, like, part of that whole thing. Because it's sick watching it at home on your own time, but it's also... Apparently the energy at that thing was incredible, and we're going to hear some sound bites from that night as well in a little bit. But yeah, it was a really, really cool experience, even sitting, you know, however many thousands of miles away across the ocean in Australia.
I know. I got bits and bites of it. Like, I saw that link come through, and it was 3 a.m. my time, so I didn't see it when it happened, but I saw it the next morning. I was like, okay, well, that... couldn't have joined that, but I saw little bits and bobs coming through on Slack of videos from the event, and I was like, oh my god, it looks so fun. I knew, we've been talking about it here, it looked like the coolest thing ever going into it. The jerseys, so cool, god damn it. The jerseys paired with the board, it made so much sense. It all worked finally, and you're like, god damn it, Shin's so good at what he does.
Yeah, if you don't know what we're talking about, we'll have some photos on the site from the premiere soon. We obviously haven't come out and outright announced the winner yet because we want to give people time to watch it and experience that for themselves, because it's very much not like you know who's going to win, even going into the final selection. That's a really big moment for us. We don't want to spoil it, but we will on the site have everything soon so you can see it and be part of it. And again, later in this podcast, we will be talking about the winner, but we'll let you know. Until then, let's get into the news, Buck.
How Mick Fanning pioneered his own terms and made an extra 10 mil. That is juicy, and this is a juicy story. So, Mikey, the year is 2001. Mick Fanning, who was not yet on tour, which just seems weird. It feels like Mick was born and then he was on tour until he retired from it. This was compelling to me, was that, whoa, he wasn't on tour his whole entire life. But no, 2001, he was not. He had won Bells as a wild card. Everybody knew he was going to go on to do big things. And he signed a deal with our friends at Red Bull for $300,000 a year. Now, pretty good, pretty healthy. 2001, that's some good coin. Surf industry is a good spot then. Red Bull was much smaller than it was, but hey, good alliance there. Now, Mick did something that nobody else has done since then, and that is sign a big global deal with Red Bull without them requiring him to put a hat on. And that is where this story begins.
Yeah, this is a... So we found out this news that Mick Fanning and Red Bull had split today on Instagram like everybody else. And we were literally just in the office and we were like, how do we talk about this without literally just copy-pasting what Mick wrote on his Instagram? Because like it doesn't even feel like we're doing anything. You know what I mean? Like, sure, you'd get a few clicks like, oh, Mick Fanning parts ways with Red Bull, blah, blah, blah. But that is the one beauty of really being in the office and working with people, because I normally work at home alone, and it allows me to be super like focused and get a lot done, but you miss out on these like collaborative idea moments. And that was a really cool one for me today, is like talking to Sam, talking to Holden, talking to Tom Bird, talking to shit, like everybody just kind of like added something to the conversation. And then we ended up with like a really cool story where we're able to add a bunch of value, things that people wouldn't have known, and that over just the years we've like collectively gathered. I mean, mostly Sam, let's be honest, but yeah. So anyway, that's where it starts in 2001 with Mick signing a deal. It ended today, but there's so much that happened in between then and now. And the big thing that you said is basically Mick pulled off the impossible. So Red Bull, as a brand, they've made it like one of their absolute staples, one of their core principles when it comes to branding, is they own your head. They insert a microchip into your brain. No, that's what Elon Musk is doing. Red Bull just likes to put a hat on your head with the Red Bull logo on it. And it makes a lot of sense. It works. And how many times now, it's like synonymous with podiums and champagne, is that Red Bull hat, right? Because they have the best athletes in pretty much every sport, and they always have that big logo up on their heads, and it's just a huge part of their branding and marketing and everything. So it makes sense. However, Mick Fanning in 2001 was already riding for a surf brand, also known as Rip Curl, with a lot of cultural power, and they were the sponsor of the event that he won in Bells, and they also had a similar thing with the hat. So basically, Mick got offered a deal with Red Bull, but they said, if that means you have to wear their hat, you can't take it if you want to ride for us. So most people look at that situation and are like, oh, shit, now I have to choose between Rip Curl and Red Bull. But that's not how Mick Fanning thought about it.
That's not how he thought about it, and that's not how he wrangled his way out of it. And he did it all without an agent. That was the craziest thing to me, is that, I mean, I would imagine this came from Sam, but no other Red Bull athlete across any discipline has done what Mick did in 2001 without an agent. That's fucking incredible. This hat rule, not really a rule, but just hat, I guess, policy that they have, is still responsible for some major moves today, namely getting Griffin Cole Pinto to Quicksilver. Billabong really wanted that hat, non-negotiable. Quicksilver's like, yeah, cool, wear a Red Bull hat, wear the rest of your kit from us, and that got him there. We also learned that Molly Picklum signed a new Rip Curl deal today, and she was in a similar predicament of Red Bull wanted her hat, Rip Curl was saying no, and she more or less called Rip Curl's bluff, signed the deal with Red Bull first, and then said, you want me or not? And they're like, ah, oh, yeah, we do. And very, very smartly re-signed that insanely talented young woman today. So,
but she went the opposite way. Yeah. It's funny. Like, she got the same net result of having both sponsors, but she has to wear the Red Bull hat. So not that that's any better or worse than wearing the Rip Curl hat, but it's still, to me, more impressive that Mick pulled it off, because Red Bull having that rule seems more imposing than Rip Curl having that rule. It's just such a bigger company with like their arms in so many different sports, you know what I mean? So it's like it just makes more sense that Red Bull's thing would be completely unflinching, and yet Mick Fanning was able to pull it off. And the really cool thing about that is he took a situation where it really appeared to be one or the other, and he still managed to get both. And that netted him at least 8 figures, at least $10 million over the course of their 23-year relationship. And if you think about it, like, was Monster ever going to pick up Mick? It doesn't really strike me as a Monster guy. Like, so that's...
Rockstar.
maybe Rockstar. But let's just assume that for whatever reason, Mick was not going to have an energy drink sponsor if it wasn't for Red Bull. That's $10 million that he now has in his life, or at least had in his life in one form or another, that just simply wouldn't have existed
if he wasn't, you know, creative and he wasn't business savvy and he wasn't just like a good dude as well, because it's one thing to get a deal, but to be able to maintain a relationship with anyone or any entity for 23 years, like, you just have to be like a really fucking solid person, I think. So yeah, the story goes into that, and it also gets into why Mick may have been dropped. And we talked to an industry insider on this one, and yeah, he had some thoughts. I mean, I guess we can leave a little bit of meat on the bone for people to go read it on the site, right?
Yeah, we'll leave a little bit of meat. But one thing I also want to bring up, though, is that this is not the first kind of miracle Mick has pulled off on the negotiations front. He has been able to ride for both FCS and Creatures, who compete across a really lot of products, leashes, traction, board bags, rides for both of them. And then he was also riding for Rip Curl at a time when they made shoes and signed with Reef. And that, of course, brought him another bucket just full of millions of dollars, because they decided to put a beer opener on the bottom of his sandal. And, you know, in hindsight, people always talk about that's kind of disgusting. Like, you can just walk around stepping in dirty stuff, potentially dog feces, or any feces, really, especially if you're in some cities these days. But I think the only thing more disgusting than potentially opening a bottle of something that's just been touching disgusting shit all day is wearing Rip Curl shoes. That's fucking hideous. So...
Yes. Well, and the other one that he pulled off that also involves Rip Curl is he's the only surfer who, even post-tour, was able to maintain $1 million salary from a surf brand, which it just, I mean, even, and that's the other thing with the Red Bull thing, like, he signed for $300,000 in 2001, and he still maintained a $250,000 annual salary with Red Bull, even post-tour, which for a brand that is so focused on, like, youth and innovation and performance and results, like, that's really, really impressive. Obviously, he was making more in his heyday. We don't have those exact numbers. We know he got some good world title bonuses over the year. So, yeah, we are very, very, very confident that he got paid at least over 10 mil when he was with Red Bull. Yeah, it's just a really fucking, it's just impressive. Like, I think they should actually, like, study this case in business classes, in, like, MBA courses. Because to be able to go in when you're basically being told it's black or it's white, and you go in there and you find some beautiful shade of gray where everybody feels like they're winning, and especially you are winning, like, it's just negotiation 101.
Oh, he found 10 million and 50 shades of gray over here.
Yeah. So good on you, Mick. Congrats to you and Red Bull. And honestly, like, you know, you never like to see these partnerships end. But also, like I said, like, 23 years together is such an impressive feat for both sides. Like, I'm sure that was incredibly symbiotic. Like, sure, Red Bull paid Mick Fanning $10 million. But imagine what he did for their brand. Like, he is, like it says in this piece, he's pretty much, as far as familiarity and lovability, like, Mick Fanning is right up there with the Australian Prime Minister. Like, everybody knows Mick Fanning, and that's largely because of the shark incident, sure, but on top of that, he's just a fucking great guy, and that comes across in everything he does, and also the business that he does too. Everybody that works with him says he's the most professional, just stand-up dude. So yeah, really, really cool. And it's it's like how surfers get paid. You just love to see the inner workings of all these things, especially with people at the highest level.
Well, like you said, there's an Instagram post that kicked this all off, and to, I think, the surprise of absolutely nobody, Mick was so gracious in just thanking them and saying this was great. So awesome to see that. The only concern I really have about this situation is he's going to be so sleepy now. Like, imagine if you've been drinking Red Bulls for 23 years. He's going to be so fucking tired. Bitcoin just hit 100K AUD. What have our Stab Edit of the Year winners done with theirs? Apparently, just the gist, getting straight into the gist, gotten a lot of weird advice from people. I felt like that was the theme here. Russell was the one that kind of said explicitly, but I've also talked to Kale since he won, and he said, like, pretty much since that happened, he had just, like, anybody from, like, his friend's dad, like, all, it just spanned generations. It was, like, people younger than him to, like, just generations older giving him crypto advice, sometimes deep crypto advice, And it turns out he's kind of just let it sit there. And is like, shit, I guess I should sell because it's like worth 100K right now. But anyway, we caught up with the two winners here. And yeah, Mikey, you fucked with crypto a bit. What's your take here?
Yeah, I mean, anybody who has looked even remotely into crypto knew that this had a very high chance of happening in 2024. It's a four-year cycle. It's not rocket science, but it is funny because, you know, crypto has this way of, it has these runs, right? And people get so excited about it and talk so much about it. And then people put a bunch of money into it, and then they either get out in time and make some money, or they don't, and then they're left holding the bag, basically. But then everybody forgets about it, right? So crypto, or Bitcoin in particular, sometime in, I think, 2022, went down to 15,000 US. Like when Kale won his Bitcoin, it was 23,000 US. And around that time, nobody cares about crypto, but that's when you need to be like the most focused and honed in, because you know that looking at the cycle, in 2024, it should come back up again. Lo and behold, here we are. It hit an all-time high of 69,000 US, which leads me to believe that the next peak will be 420. But that remains to be seen. There is a halving event coming up, which I'm not going to pretend to know exactly what that means, but apparently it's a big deal and makes the price go up. But yeah, it was really funny. Like we saw the price go up. Everyone in the office talking about it. It's like, oh, I wonder what Kale and Russ are doing or have done with their Bitcoin. And the good news is they have both been hodling. They held it, and it's paid off really well for them so far. But then it begs the question, like, when do you sell, or do you sell at all?
Well, I had this thing happen. It was already when we had the first one going. Like, we bought the first one, I think, probably price similar to when I bought mine. It wasn't like at its peak, but it was still pretty high. It wasn't at like 15K, like when it was.
No, we bought it at 40K.
Like you were just talking about? 40, yeah. But, you know, you said it went down to whatever, 15. It wasn't like I bought it down there. I bought it probably right around 40. Because, yeah, that makes sense with where it's at now. But it was so funny because I bought it. I hadn't been, like, COVID happened. I was just trapped in France for a while. And I don't think it was as much of a phenomenon there as it was in the US. And so it was like one of my first trips out of France since COVID. And I was in Hawaii and I was surrounded by, like, I think the most, the prime people for crypto, which was just like
Hawaiian vloggers,
you know, 20 something year old males and Hawaiian vloggers. And everybody's talking about this thing. I'm like, fuck, okay, I guess I should buy it. And I put like a grand into it, which is now worth, like, I always thought it was funny because I would just look at my PayPal account and it would just show like investments and it would just show this red line down. And I was like, that looks funny. Like, and I actually like the aesthetic of it so much more than it telling me now that I've made like $600. It's so much funnier to see a line pointing sharply down telling you you're a failure than it is to see, like, hey, dude, you want $600 on a thing that, like, it's funny. But, anyway, Russ bought a nice car too, but that was not Bitcoin money. That was maybe a little SEOTY bonus money from a sponsor, a little gift.
How sweet is that now that
I can relate?
That's part of an incentive for sponsored surfers. Like, we've been doing this for 2 years now, Stab Editor of the Year, and obviously Stab Surfer of the Year for a bit longer than that. And it's like come around. Obviously, the surfer poll was like such a big deal for so long, and we don't right now at least have like a major event that everybody attends, but the fact that surfers are starting to like take this seriously and sponsors as well, like it's pretty cool. Like it's really exciting for us, and that puts us in a really funny position for 2024, because obviously we're still going to do this whole thing, but we didn't buy another Bitcoin when it was down at 15K. We bought two Bitcoin at the very beginning and we're not holding one right now. So now we're like, oh my God, like how are we going to do this? Like we haven't fully committed yet to the 2024 Bitcoin. We're trying to think of like other ways that we can get people a prize that's kind of dynamic and fun like that without maybe spending the price that it's at right now, 100K Aussie.
Can we get Ethereum?
Yeah, we could get a few Ethereum. Yeah, that's fair.
How much is that?
It just doesn't have the same ring to it, though. Oh, yeah, we're going to give away 3.87 Ethereum.
I mean, hey, whatever gets us there, right? But that is cool. I agree. It was a good point about that working its way into contracts now. It makes sense, though. Like, I think especially with a brand like O'Neill, like, they are still so clearly in touch with the core. Some brands are, some brands aren't. They strike me as one that is very in touch with it. I mean, they sponsored this year's Stop in the Dark. They brought that project to life. Like, they seem to know the difference between, like, oh, I got a million hits on a fucking shitty video, and, like, hey, I created something that made a real impact to the people that matter.
Yep. Could be Jordy's year.
I had a weird dream about Jordy Smith the other day, and it could be. Should you surf a CT venue the day before the comp runs? So I wish, Mikey, it worked out perfectly like this, but to be honest, I did have a dream about Jordy Smith the other night. He visited me in my REM state. He was wielding a knife.
Wow.
He was wielding a knife. I've been watching The Last of Us. I know I'm very late to this. Hit HBO show, very high reviews. Bit violent for me, and I feel when I watch violent shows, it seeps into my nighttime state, and I have really weird, creepy, violent dreams. One of them involving Jordy Smith and knife. Could be his year. Anyway, to investigate that more deeply, let's roll the clock back to this Tuesday, March 5th, Portugal. I love Super Tubos. I live not far from it, about 20 kilometers. It takes me 30 minutes to get there, sometimes a little bit less, sometimes a little bit more. I really do surf that wave as much as I can. It is one of my favorite waves in the world, maybe my favorite wave in the world at this point. I just love it. It's like reliably you're going to get a good wave when you go there when it's on. Tuesday was kind of on, and it was also the day before the CT contest is about to be on. And mind you, this is pre-mid-year cut, so the field of surfers with men and women is 54. So you have 54 of the world's, I don't want to say best surfers, I'm not going to say they're the very best surfers in the world, but 54 of some of the world's best surfers, surely some of the world's most like tuned in, just like athletic, sharp, focused surfers. And you have,
because it's not, the cut hasn't happened yet, so there's just this like weight over everything.
Oh, and it's just, you're two events down. Portugal is just kind of like, you know, Hawaii is one leg, right? And then Australia is one leg. Portugal is just this weird little
bridge
island,
yeah,
far away from both those places, that I think is where shit really starts to get tense. Like, if you're not in a good spot and you fuck up here, you're really off it, and, you know, maybe you save yourself here. It's kind of weird. It's winter. It's fucking pissing rain sideways right now with wind. It's weird vibes. So I had this kind of dilemma of like, okay, if the CT wasn't in town, there's no doubt that I'm going up there that day to surf it with conditions like that. Like, supers can take a north wind, which a lot of other waves here can't, at least in my direct area. And so I always go on days like that. Like, it's absolutely a day I'd be there if there's not a CT about to happen and 54 of the world's best surfers surfing it, trying to like get in the zone. And I really had to think about it. I was like, do I just surf way worse waves in front of my house? Pretty much have a shocker. Like, I've done that a lot. Surfed on days there where it looks bad and it turns out, yes, it is. Or do I go and try to get some good waves at supers? And so, spoiler alert here, I did. I went, I surfed it, and I wrote about it. But it really was this weird ethical dilemma. Mikey, what would you have done in my shoes here?
I would have surfed as well. If I lived there and that's a wave that I normally surf and the waves hadn't been good for a long time and I knew it was going to be good that day, it's also like, it's a big enough break, I think, that you can justify it. It's harder to justify at a spot like J Bay or whatever, where it's just one continuous wave that connects all the way. You know what I mean? Everybody's trying to get the same thing. And then you have like a wave like Pipeline, which is obviously a concentrated lineup, but it's almost like, do you even make a difference out there? Like, there's already so many people. I probably wouldn't try to surf pipe before an event, but it just seems like hectic. But I don't know. I think at Super Tubos, like, there's enough peaks, there's enough waves, and they're probably surfing at staggered times of the day. Like, to me, it's not that big of a deal, but I could see how, if you're on the other side of the coin, if you're a CT surfer, you're like, no, don't fucking surf. Like, imagine any other sport where you have to like fight just to practice your thing. Like, it's crazy. Like, if like Tiger Woods is getting ready for an event and people are just hitting golf balls into him, or Michael Jordan is trying to freaking practice his free throw and some dude's coming out and just like swatting him out of the way. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy.
Exactly, especially coming from Hawaii, and then a lot of them coming from, again, board shorts, the ISA game, World Games in Puerto Rico, like adjusting to a whole new vibe, just different ocean, different way it's moving, different these massive tides, like everything is different here. You're in a way thicker wetsuit. You really just want like your day or two. Like the weekend, there were little moments, but it was like mostly bad. Like that was clearly the best day, honestly, of what the forecast looks like we're having so far for supers. Like if they're able to move it, the places that favor more south wind are going to be good next week, so maybe they can shift it. I don't know. Maybe I'll look into that. But it was a weird thing, Mikey.
But there's also like ways to go about it. Like there are good ways and bad ways to do it. I think first of all, if your surfing level is not really there, I don't think you should do it. Like if you're just kind of like a, you know, intermediate or average surfer, then you're trying to surf a CT venue with all these guys, and you're just gonna get in the way is the reality of it. Not 'cause you're doing anything like wrong necessarily, but just the level that they surf at relative to you is going to be very apparent, and they're probably going to be trying to take off on parts of the wave where you're either taking off way down the line or you're getting caught inside or something like that. So I think there's that. And then just you mentioned it in here, like your rule was that you weren't going to go or even really look at waves that CT surfers were looking at. And I think if you're doing that, if you're respectful, if you know how to surf and work your way around a lineup without being a nuisance, the problem is that I'm sure a lot of people think that they can do that, and then reality kicks in, and you're like, oh, I want to get a wave, or, you know, oh, there's freaking Connor O'Leary. He's my favorite surfer. I want him to see me get barreled. And there's this weird ego thing about it, too, right? It's like, oh, I want to get a sick wave in front of CT surfers. So I feel like that plays into it, too. I don't know if you felt that, but it's just this natural thing. When you're around good surfers, you want to surf well, you want them to think you surf well.
I get that. I think it's like a double-edged sword. On one side, yeah, you'd like to have your 30 years of effort flailing around the ocean pay off in some way. I did make the decision, and we did an Instagram poll to see what our audience would have done. About 75% of people said I made the right call in going out, 25% said no. You have any opinions on that, Mikey?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're not going to vote against yourself, right? Like, the same way that you asked CT surfers if we should do that, and they laughed in your face. So,
Oh, the laugh is such a no, don't do that. They're too polite. They're not gonna say, yeah, it's probably better that you don't do that. Like it's a very stressful thing that we're in. We have five events to prove our slot, or we're like just contractually fucked for the next year. Can we please just have this one day to ourselves to try to get our shit in order? They're not gonna say that. They're just gonna laugh. Like their laughter is an absolute yeah, like I really wish people didn't do what you're doing right now. Sorry, Crosby and Kanoa.
there's always going to be people who fuck up and ruin it for everyone. But I think if you know that you can do it respectfully, it's fair game. The ocean's free for everyone, even if they have a bunch of tents on the ground saying otherwise.
They have so many tents there. They have so many tents, Mikey. Stab in the dark with the Kalo hand, you know, episode 4. Reminder, this is the final episode. If you have not yet watched it, bail from this podcast right now.
Turn it
Do
off.
not let us spoil it for you. Like and subscribe, or whatever you have to do to get like podcast metrics up, do that for sure. But stop watching or listening, whatever you do right now, because the winner of this year's Stab in the Dark is.
Wait.
We'll get there. We'll get there. We'll get there. This episode takes us, episode 4 takes us not only to the ancient Mongolian village of Xanadu, but also to the modern Sumbawan village of Lakey Peak. Kalohandino brings 4 boards with him, the DHD, the Timmy Patterson, the Pukas, and the Chris Borst. And one of those boards is hoisted in the air beside a few mopeds after. And things, we also see Unlucky 13 tested. I mentioned the Xanadu village before. And yes, she comes back out by none other than one of the people who laughed in my face when I said, Hey, is it am I kind of tripping to like surf CT venue before the CT happens? He just laughed. Crosby, Cole, Pinto.
Very well done. Yeah, Crosby, he was such a good addition. Like, it was so funny watching him like break the board down and then absolutely tore the shit out of this board. And then maybe my
Oh my
favorite part of the
God, they're
series,
so good.
it's insane. And then maybe my favorite part of the series was at the very end, like basically after the credits, like the part that you only get to if you're just like so locked in and having so much fun watching it. Kolohe and him have this interaction in the last minute of the show. It's just so funny. I don't even want to, or maybe we'll play a little snippet here. Yeah, let's drop it in.
Hey, did you guys do the deal already?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Well, did you see all the boards?
Surf on
Like,
them?
did you know all the
Yeah.
boards? Like, you had to figure out which ones are which?
Yeah.
Were you correct with?
Any of them?
Yeah.
No.
Really?
But not one.
Holy shit.
Except for the mat, hopefully.
Not one.
Yeah, except for the mat. Not one.
Not one board.
No, I was not correct on one board.
Really?
Yeah.
Crazy. What about the final four? Were you?
Nope.
Not you didn't have one in there that you were right.
No.
What?
Yeah.
Holy shit, that's
I thought I had
crazy.
these four and they were something completely different.
No way.
Yeah.
Was it a surprise the one that won?
Yeah, I was tripping.
Like you're like in a good way? Like it wasn't like some like well-known shaper, was it?
Oh, no, who won was a well-known shaper, yeah.
Or what?
Yeah.
Al Mary?
No.
Sharpie?
No, I'm not going to tell you. Don't do that game.
Faisal?
No.
Xanadu?
Yeah. Everyone's a Xanadu.
Yeah.
And while we are still talking about this Xanadu board, which, like you said, he ripped the hell out of, we mentioned the shaper profiles on here before. And this one, I don't know if it's just because it was the last one, or maybe I just didn't know enough about Xanadu before, but I want to say my favorite one, just learning that his father was an engineer and architect and built a crazy beach house, called it Xanadu after an ancient Mongolian city. And then that's how the guy just that's he earned a nickname based on that. And I think we called this out before too, but by the time he was 17, which is in 1977, he was operating his own surfboard factory. He's just a fascinating guy.
Because he had a dream.
And
We should be heeding more our dreams. I don't know exactly how it ended up with Jordy in the
I
night.
had a dream. He was dangerous, is all I'll say. And it could be his year.
It is, yeah. So Xanadu, what a fascinating character. Like, just Danny had a lot of fun and frustration writing that part of the script, which, bravo, by the way, Danny, like, brought Stab in the Dark to a whole new level this year. Obviously, so many other people involved in that, like Shin doing all of the graphics and overlay for that, Dylan piecing the entire thing together, among other writers and helpers and editors and everything like that. But if you don't know what we're talking about, it's just on such a different level, the storytelling in this one. So Xanadu is on that. Also, DHD had a crazy backstory with Kolohe that it there's one section that basically says that DHD via McFanning decided to send Kolohe some boards over to California that never made it to Kolohe because Dino and Dino blocked them from getting to Kolohe. And what's interesting about that is that Kolohe found out about this in the premiere while watching Stab in the Dark. That's the level of research that Danny went to, as he was finding out things about Kolohe's life that Kolohe didn't even know happened. And he's looking over at his dad like, what the f did that actually happen? His dad's like, yes, yeah, sorry.
Interesting ride back to San Clemente then, wasn't it?
Yeah, especially yeah,
So who ended up winning?
we'll get to that, but before we've been talking on this podcast a lot about the premiere and how we were going to have all the surfers or sorry all the shapers on stage with Kolohe. It turned out we were one short. Axel Lorenz couldn't make it because he'd had heart surgery about 2 weeks prior, which we actually talked about in the Stab interview that we did with him back then. So he wasn't able to make it, but that left Timmy Patterson, DHD, and Chris Borst to go to the La Paloma Theater, where we had an unbelievable event. Apparently, Christian Bocut, who was one of Stab's new hires, he's the Stab Premium Coordinator, he was on door duty. And we wanted to make sure that our premium members all got in first because they get first dibs. They got, you know, free tickets. Anybody else could come in and pay a fee. But there were two lines, one for premium, one for general admission. And apparently we just had to cut off the general admission line because it was so packed with premium members. And he got verbally assaulted, like people booing him, hissing at him, basically like throwing tomatoes at him. And just like imagine outside of this like iconic theater and you just have this like really nice Mormon kid trying to do tickets, trying to make sure that everybody gets in that needs to. And they just tell him like, oh, yeah, we've hit our capacity. And he's just trying to hold him back and they're just yelling at him.
There is a life lesson to be learned there. It's that if you are going to, if you're setting out to do something where you might be denied by a well-mannered Mormon child, bring tomatoes because you might need them. So that's my advice to people. Just be ready. We love Christian. Christian, I'm sorry that people threw tomatoes at you, though. I understand their reasoning. It seemed by all accounts to be an incredible event. And if I couldn't get in there and I had any sort of fresh produce on my hands, even at one point I had some frozen tuna and me and my friend, we threw it at a thing that made a really loud noise. I would have thrown maybe some tuna if I had that. So I understand the frustration, but who won?
Well, before we get into that, we do want to run a piece of the audio from the chat that the Shapers had before the thing aired. So this is before they found out who won and who didn't win. So, let's hear from Timmy, Chris Borst, Darren Hanley, Kalohan Dino, and our host from Stab, Aaron Carrera.
We only give them the dimensions, the height and weight of the surfer, their fin preference, and where we're going. So, Timmy, the closest to brother, why don't you, who was your first guess of who you thought it was this year?
Brother.
Darren?
Every year when I get invited, I just send the email straight to Mick Fanning, go, who is it? And he went through and looked, and he said, yeah, it's definitely Chloe. I thought, oh, that's easy.
Yeah, I called around for a few people. Then I called Jordy Collins, and he thought it was Medina. So I was way off.
You hear it now over and over again in each season, what it means to hold a surfboard, and they go, oh, this feels like an Australian board. So I'm going to ask you first, like, what that actually means and what gives it away, and then Darren, get your take on that as well.
Going to run me through the test, see what I say? I always felt like it was the lightness of the glassing. That was about it. I always heard. Now you're going to embarrass me because they might correct me, but I've always heard that when it's hotter, the resin is thinner, so it's easier to get the board lighter. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay. Not that stupid. So I think because it's so hot down there, they could get the boards lighter. And then especially in like January and February, you could really tell a difference because it's so cold here. So it was always the weight that, for me, gave it away.
That's a pretty good answer. Darren?
You're spot on that. Like Mick Fanning used to always say, he wish he could order his whole 100 boards in January, February, because they're better, they're lighter. There's something about the humidity at that time makes a board a lot better. But I think the difference between Australian boards and American boards, I feel, is just, I don't know, the noses are thinner, there's more rocker because our waves are more curvy and stuff like that, and we specialise in that sort of boards. But it's the same as me trying to make boards for surfing some like Huntington and stuff like that. It's quite difficult for me, but to make boards for good waves, because we have a lot of good waves being Snapper, Durambar, Kira, and all those spots, it sort of comes natural.
Timmy, you said something earlier that you'll wake up in the middle of the night and just get inspired by something, and you have to go shape that board. Was this one of those moments where it just came to you, or did you
totally. Yeah. I just had an idea. I'm like, I did one, an Idlo for Idlo, and he didn't like it. that was pissed. But I'm like, I'm just going to do what I like to do, my thing, instead of, I didn't even think about it so much. I'm like, I like this board. It works good. It's kind of what the guys used to ride. I mean, I'm taking rockers off older boards, like literally measuring from Matt Archibald to Timmy Reyes, Jordy's old boards that I've shaped, and they're all identical.
And on that point, something kind of moving on to with Chris right here, this next one's for you. I'm not sure how they figured this out, but something that we all admired that he did was when you dropped off your surfboard to the office, I think it was just a couple days before we had to leave to go on that shoot. At that point, all the other boards submitted were lined up, and you could see, I think it was either 6 or 8 boards up there. And most times when a shaper drops a board off, they drop theirs off, don't kind of turn a blind eye to the rest there and walk out of the office. But you stood there, and you looked at each one, even picked them up. And I think one of the first things we heard you say was, fuck, I should have done a squash, or what was it, round tail? Or what? You had something, your reaction to it. How did that sort of take us into that room and what that felt like, and even, any regret? Or, yeah, just talk us through that.
Yeah, because I was thinking about doing a round tail, then Taylor said something about just doing a squash tail, and I wind up dropping the boards off, they dropped the boards off, and I seen all these round tails, and I was just like, oh my God, I shouldn't have listened to them. Thought I screwed up.
So after this moment,
so
we premiered the film. It was 43 minutes long, so a lot of anticipation built, thanks to the incredible storytelling of the team who put this thing together. And at the end, Chris Borst was named fourth place. Kolohe brought these boards to Lakey Peak. He ripped the shit out of them. The waves were about as fun and as board test friendly as you could ever find anywhere in the world. I was just like, oh my God, this is literally board test heaven. But he rode the Borst. He kicked that one out. He brought it down to 3 boards. He decided to surf those 3 boards on the final day. So he had the Timmy, he had the Borst, he had the DHD. Watching this, did you have any inkling of who he might pick?
Honestly, I kind of thought Timmy. I had a weird feeling about Timmy. But before that, because sorry, Timmy, you make incredible boards. As you know, you didn't win this year. It was 22. Who was it, Mikey? Can we get there?
Well, we can get there, but I will say one more kind of fun fact is stab-in-the-dark surfers are not allowed to watch the clips while they're on trips. We've talked about this before. We talked about how JS has had maybe an unfair run based on feel, because in appearance they like have looked so good under so many surfers' feet, but they weren't necessarily getting that same, you know, feedback from just their feelings in the wave. When Kolohe watched the finale for the first time, seeing his surfing on all 3 of these boards side by side in very similar waves, he thought that the Timmy might have actually looked best. That's from an inside source on the ground there, that Kolohe was thinking, oh man, I might have actually had like more power, more drive with the Timmy. But this is not, we don't live in a retrospective world. We have to look forward. We live in the present. Kolohe, hindsight maybe 2020, but you chose your winner. And well, let's just let him take it away.
So nervous. I'm fucking nervous. All right, so the winner of this year's Stab in the Dark was number 22, and it's a Xanadu. No! Fuck, it's a DHT! That's such a mind warp moving forward. Oh my God. Fuck, Darren, you did good. I don't know what to say. Had some really good boards off you before in the past and kind of changed the way I ordered my boards from Matt. Super blown away that it's you. And I don't really know what to say, but the board fucking ripped. It worked good. And congratulations. Thank you. That was like the worst possible thing to do for my mind. Like proper.
There was some surprise there.
Ah, 22. And that box from Mick. Just, where did those boards go, you think? Who ended up with them?
No, I think they ended up on OfferUp right next to the Xanadu board. So we, at the premiere, we had raffle tickets. All the Stab Premium members that came in had raffle tickets. I think other people could, like, buy them as well. But we did this giveaway at the end for a few boards. And the Xanadu was one of those boards that got given away to a woman. And within 12 hours of her getting that board, we showed up at the office the next day and went on OfferUp, and it was on OfferUp for $1,250.
Is it still up there?
I'll have to check.
Is that offer still up?
I'm not sure, but she's taken the Taj Burrow method.
Wow. Well, hey, if you want that, Crosby looked real. It was the real one that he wrote?
I'm not actually sure if it was that one. I think it might have been. I don't think it was the replica, because each year we get two boards from the shapers, like the one that Kolohe is going to, or the surfer is going to test, and a replica, so that we can have it for events and eventually give it away to some premium members. I'm not sure exactly which one, but.
Well, if you're Crosby size, I mean. The board looked pretty magic. 1250 is not that bad of a deal. 1200, 1250.
Would you pay 1200 for like a guaranteed magic board? You would, right?
Oh, that's tough. You don't know how long it's going to last.
Yeah, but you're basically paying, what, 750 for just a chance? You'd kind of have to take the guarantee, right?
That's for somebody that's Kolohe and Crosby's size. That's for them to answer right now, not for me. I'll cross that bridge when I come to it, brother.
True. Okay, so obviously that'll happen, but Kolohe's reaction to hearing that DHD won was fucking incredible, because they obviously have this amazing history, like back to those boards that didn't make it to him. There was the whole J-Bay incident that is like, that story is told really, really well in the episode. They just go back a really long way, and it sounds like now Kolohe is just in like a head spin cycle about what to do, because he has obviously been off tour this year. He wants to get back on tour. He's been surfing the QS. He's going to be surfing the Challenger Series. And a big part of that has to be like, what's my best chance of success? You want to be on the boards that you're the most confident on, period. And it sounds like he is just in an absolute mind fuck right now about what he should be riding.
And you touched on it just now, Mikey, but in 2019, they actually got under his feet. They were shipped and they made it beneath his feet, which is going to come up shortly in this program. So I'm not going to divulge too much here. But he, after feeling some success on those things, he kind of tried to get a batch that was like a little bit mayhem, or Matt's as he calls them now. Matt, what else? With some DHD, like kind of what, like almost just a little mix of what both of them are doing, and it didn't seem to work well, which neither you nor I shape or design surfboards, but both of us deal with writing a lot. And you know, you can't just take like one person's writing and slap it into another person's, like it just doesn't work. And that was the only analogy I could come up with when I thought about that. I was like, oh, maybe like those guys know surfboards so well that every little detail must just be like,
it complements the next thing
so much. Yeah. Yeah. It's just so dialed in. If you change one thing,
right,
it throws off everything. You can't just go a mix. You can't just Frankenstein it. No, I don't think
it's like, yeah, everything is built to connect really together. Yeah. Yeah. It's so, of course that didn't work in retrospect, but now Kolohe's got some decisions to make. He did say that in the episode, like when he was picking the winners, that he was, you know, going to stay with Matt no matter what. But as somebody who is, I think he's like almost 30 now, or 30 now, like he needs to make a decision like for his career and his longevity. Like, how is he going to have the best chance at getting back on tour and achieving some more of that success? So.
Well, Mikey, what else is going on? What's on the site? What's next? Did you see that swell in Fiji? I saw Billy Kemper fall out of an aeroplane.
He sure did.
Did you see that one?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was one of my favorites.
I saw Jai Glindemann surf and wave very well. Just incredibly well. Perfectly. Just technically sound. You see anything I missed? Any wave highlights from that swell? The Billy Kemper falling out of the aeroplane was the most stunning thing I saw out of it so far, but I may have missed some.
Well, Soli Bailey got, like Jai's, maybe even like, maybe better than Jai's, questionable, depends on what you like, but just the most perfectly like paced barrel, where he's just cruising at the exact same speed as the wave in the barrel for probably 10 seconds in a whatever 15-foot tube, which was insane. Nate Florence had not necessarily a very Nate Florence-esque wave. I feel like he's normally very deep and like behind the foam ball. This was one where it was just so picturesque that he literally posted a picture of it, of him just standing tall backside in a giant cave, not especially deep, but just like one of those iconic surf photo moments. So yeah, it looked like a really special swell over there. It's the same one that actually passed by the east coast of Australia right now. And we have some more on the way, which is exciting, not just for me because I happen to be here right now, but also for another board testing project that is near and dear to our hearts. And that's Electric Acid with Dave Rostovich, which is being filmed at this very moment. So that'll be dropping sometime this year. We're going to film in the east coast of Australia and maybe do the final somewhere special as well. Danny Johnson is also onto that one, which is very exciting news for anybody who likes quality surf entertainment. And just Danny does such a good job of mixing actually like entertainment and knowledge. He's so brilliant at what he does. So that's going on. And as far as next week, we have a film, Vacation 2, which is, if you remember last year, we went to Kandui with the winners of Stab Highway, both Australia and US. This time we took the winners of Stab Highway Europe down to Costa Rica and we made a surf film with them. So that'll be dropping next week. We also might have a Cheat Codes with Coco Ho. We're just waiting on a few things there. It's definitely happening. It's just a matter of whether it drops next week or not. Portugal will presumably resume probably early next week.
No, it won't.
It won't?
It's over.
It's over? Okay.
No, it will. It will.
And don't you have a, you still have a premiere or two over in Europe, right? For Stab in the Dark?
We got one popping off in the UK. Apparently 250 people. Apparently it's already maxed out guest list. We were going to send an email out.
All the people that couldn't make it guest list into La Paloma already, just stormed over to Europe.
They went to Nuki in Southwest Britain. So they'll be there. And then, yeah, we have one, a nice stormy night in Peniche on Saturday as well. So,
but for now, let's go to the WQS.
Let's go to QS!
World Christine.
Damo. Damo, welcome to the drop. Welcome to the WQS, more importantly. I don't know if you've ever spent any time in the WQS before, but it's a really fun place. You get to see the world. You get to spend all your money. And you get to the chance at a dream of qualifying for the big leagues. But in this world, we don't have a big leagues, but we do have a big prize. So every week, we give our premium members a chance to get their premium membership comped for a year, which is also true for you. But because we just watched the finale of Stab in the Dark, we're going to be giving away one of the replica boards if you can get 2 out of 3 questions right today. First and foremost, though, tell us a little bit about yourself. And I don't wear a shirt often, but if I did, it would definitely have my name on it.
Yeah, of course. You got me good there. It's embarrassing when you go out at night too and all you have to wear is shirts with your name on it. It's rad.
If you're going
to
wear a shirt, it might as well be me. I think I agree with exactly. Mike.
Exactly. You got it.
Go on. Go on.
Me, old surf industry vet, worked in the industry for 20 years, left about 6 years ago, started my own little surf academy here in Perth at Triggs, just looking after up-and-coming Grom. So putting back into the world that I've taken so much from. So living the good life. It was either going to be real estate or surf coaching, where all ex-industry or ex-pro surfers go. I ended up with surf coaching, luckily.
Good choice. I like that choice. See many of the other choice, but yeah, good. Surf coaching. Nice. How are the kids looking over there? Got any up-and-comers you want to call out?
A couple little Groms. I mainly look after the kids in the city. So a couple little kids, Harris Groms, Scott's, there's two twins, Scott's. The Scott twins, they're pretty good. They're coming. They could have a crack if they, you know.
We haven't seen twins on tour in a while. It's been a minute since
the Hobgoods. The Hobgoods. So that's, I used to work for Rusty. So Hobgoods were part of those Rusty days. So it's pretty cool dealing with those guys as well.
All right, I'm gonna give you question number one here. This week, it was revealed that Kolohe surfed one Stab in the Dark finalist board to a semifinal finish in the 2019 J-Bay event before switching back to his Mayhem and losing. Who shaped this board? Was it A, Timmy Patterson, B, Pukas, or C, Darren Hanley? What do you got for us, Damo?
Darren Hanley, the DHD.
Bam! Nailed it. Boom. Nailed it. You've certainly watched the episode. That is quite a compelling narrative going on in there. So I don't want to spoil too much if there's some listeners who haven't watched it. But of course, after soliciting J-Bay tips from Mick Fanning, a batch of DHDs were sent over to South Africa for Kolohe, leading to his best ever result in the event. Brother was apparently so paranoid that people would see the DHD logos on his board that he ran down the beach with the board in a board sock, ripping it off just before he jumped into the keyhole. I don't remember that, but I feel like seeing board socks on the beach, it always confuses me. I feel like it's a very European trait when you see somebody just like bringing a fucking board bag down and just having it on the beach. I'm like, you don't really need to do that, do you? So I'm kind of surprised I missed that in 2009. I do have a keen eye, but it's 2019, not 2009. But what's your stance on board socks on the beach? Are you for or are you against, Damo?
It just reminds me of Cornwell for some reason. Yes, he says European, but yep, I'm back in cloth board bags on the sand. Nothing like sand getting in that cloth, getting in your wax. It's unreal.
I feel like the board sock on the beach, it pairs well with Uggs for some reason. That's just in my mind. And like maybe a beanie too. Something about fluffiness on the beach. Yeah. Anyway, question down, one correct. Getting into number two. This weekend, the Australian Board Riders Battle will take place at Burleigh Heads with 42 teams and 210 surfers battling for Australian Surf Club supremacy. Who won this event in 2023? Was it A, the Byron Bay Board Riders, B, Snapper Rock Surf Riders, or C, Yelling Up Board Riders?
I'm going to have a stab in the dark and say A, Byron Bay.
Bam! Wow.
Oh! Yeah, boys!
It was a bit of an underdog story, actually, if you believe the narrative on the Australian surf whatever website. But yeah, it was a stab high / highway star Dakota Walters who really set his team on a path to victory. He got a 9.33 for a giant backside fin waft, which is a very dangerous maneuver when you can only surf one wave per person. And Dakota was joined on the podium by fellow Byron Bay surfers and former CTers Soli Bailey and Danny Wills. But you might be happy to hear this, Damo. This year we heard that Yelling Up is bringing in the big guns with Taj Burrow and Jay Davies. And there's a solid swell on the way for Burleigh. So maybe it could be coming back to WA this year.
It could be. And my local beach, Trig Point Board Riders, have made it over. So we're like the underdogs compared to Yelling Up and Margaret River. And the boys are there to represent. Coming from the world's worst wave to Burleigh, they're not going to know what they're going to do. They're going to take off and then go for a couple of kilometres. They won't flick off because we're so used to short, sharp waves. Boys from Triggs will just go from the start to the finish. They'll forget.
Well, they got to get off the rocks. It's a great novelty. That's step one.
Yeah, that's going to be great viewing, isn't it? Bit of blood.
Oh, that's exciting. This is a good guess for this one. We've got a personal story here. I would have went Snapper on that one, but that's because I still think 3 Degrees is a new movie in my head. I'm like, oh, yeah. Nick, Parko, Dingo, that's up and comers.
And the boys.
The boys. All right. Well, 2 for 2. Wow. All right. Already got the membership, but we have a third question for you. Let's see how you go. On day one of the Portugal CT event, Griffin Colapinto cost Mikey $100 by getting a triangle in the last 30 seconds of his heat. With which surfer did he interfere? Was it A, Liam O'Brien, B, Callum Robson, or C, Ryan Callanan? What do you got?
Mr. Bonsoy, B.
It was Mr. Bonsoy, of course. I saw a hilarious comment from Kobe Aberdeen on, I think, the WSL's thing, calling Griffin a dancing boy. Anyway, it was
he blew easy. It.
Yeah, it was wild. Callum still had priority when Griffin took off in front of him, despite paddling briefly for the wave prior. The judges did not deem Callum's paddle enough to switch priority, as Griffin appeared to believe. So Griffin got sent to the elimination round, and Mikey will have to go without lunch this entire week. You ready for a bonus question relevant to this heat?
Check it in.
Which surfer, who was in third place prior to the interference, made his first ever CT heat as a result of Griffin's blunder?
Bum, bum. A file.
Ooh.
And give me an issue. An issue. Come on.
It's a pretty tough one. It's a 16-year-old from here. So.
Yeah. I never heard of him. Unfortunately, I'm presume I will hear from him, but he's gone. I don't know.
You're Euro prejudiced. Hate Euro.
I'm a like West Australian. I live in a bubble.
This guy shows up with his board bag on the beach, just puts it in the sand. No, he has the same initials as my fellow Mikey here. His name is Mateus Cagnotto. Super promising kid, rides for Rip Curl. So when Kelly pulled out, it was a Rip Curl sponsored event. They were like, yo, you want to take Kelly Slater's spot in this CT event at your local wave? And he was like, yeah. And then Griffin kind of gifted him the win. He landed a massive value in a recent free surf. So he's great. But yeah, tough coming up against, I think he's in Jack Robinson's heat for the next round. So
he won the worst heat ever on Stab Highway. So he's got a chance.
He did win. Given this forecast, he might have to rely on that experience to get it done against Jack. So let's see.
Jack is from Triggs, and that's probably one of the worst waves you can get. So if it's going to be bad, he's going to tap back into when he was 60-year-old living at Triggs, and he's going to perform.
Wow. Well, by next episode, we'll know the results of this heat. We'll know who gets it done and what could be. Let's hope the forecast changes, but could be the worst heat ever. Anyway, you went 3 for 3. You did not get the bonus question, but you still win something. Mike, what do we got for him? Free membership.
Oh, we got a free membership. Prizes. And we got a Stab in the Dark replica board. This is a special podcast right here. Yeah, no, this is huge. Yeah, this is huge. And you were one of the first signups again to get on this show. We have like a list of, I think, 700 some premium members who signed up when we did this. So congrats on getting in there early. And if you're on the list, watch your phone line, because we'll be texting on a weekly basis another premium member.
You guys are amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Good luck in the board riders battle. Get it done for Triggs. Mikey and I also come from a place where you can't stand up and away for more than 5 or 6 seconds. So our hearts are with you.
All right, thanks, boys. Keep ripping. Love your work.
Thank you, as always, for listening to The Drop. Another great week in surfing. Plenty more surfing to come, especially next week. It looks like Portugal, I mean, they kind of have to run, right? Like, they got the waiting period. We're going to get through this storm together, and then we're going to hopefully get to a great result. Go, Gabby. I know you're in the elimination round right now. I'm sure you can dig yourself out of this hole. Yeah, I think that's about it for now. But the Stab staff may be going on a bit of a sabbatical. Yeah, now we're going to be working, but we're going to be doing some team bonding exercises, hopefully in some tubes on the Australian East Coast this week. So if you see us out there, say hi or flip us off and tell us to go fuck ourselves. Over and out.